And good morning and welcome to Lambda Weekly, the world's oldest, longest running gay and lesbian radio show anywhere in the world. Well, if it's the world's oldest, it would be the longest in the world.
Right.
We're coming up on our 30th anniversary, and we have some exciting stuff coming up for our 30th anniversary. Our guests today, though, are from the Holocaust Museum and from a production that's going on at the Holocaust Museum. We have Pam Barnes. She's the Development and Volunteer Coordinator. Maria McMullen, she's the Senior Director of Advancement. We have Joe Watts, who's the Director of Timekeepers. Carl Lewis and Jeremy Smith, who are appearing in the show. We're going to do a scene from the show. We have lots of stuff to do today. Right now, sitting at our mics are Pam and Maria. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Tell us, where is the Holocaust Museum?
The museum is in the West End, historic district of Dallas, on Record Street, 211 North Record Street, right behind the sixth-floor museum.
I want to talk a little bit about, I love this museum, and I've been supporting it because for years I just love this museum. Tell us a little bit about the museum. What does it do that's different than, like, the National Holocaust Museum?
First, I want to tell you what our mission statement is, because I think it's important that people understand really what's behind the programs and activities of the museum. We are dedicated to preserving the memory of the Holocaust and to teaching the moral and ethical response to prejudice, hatred, and indifference for the benefit of all humanity. And what that really means is that we're the only organization in this region, that includes North Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, New Mexico, Louisiana, that is dedicated to teaching the Holocaust and having people work through in education programs and other projects and through our exhibits, learning tolerance and becoming more accepting of all different groups and cultures that they interact with.
And one thing Maria doesn't want us to mention is that our Holocaust Museum is better than Houston's.
Well, we don't compete. We love the Houston Holocaust Museum, and the museum in Dallas is slightly different from many of the others in the country. There are about 19 Holocaust museums across the country. We're fortunate enough to live in a region where there is one, where you can jump in your car and pretty much, you know, 2 hours in any direction, you can come in and visit the exhibit. Our exhibit is smaller than the U.S. Museum, which is a very, very large exhibit, multiple exhibits. We have about 5,000 square feet of exhibit space. We have two galleries. One is a large gallery that has a primary exhibit that focuses on one day in the Holocaust, April 19th, 1943, and three events that took place on that day. And then we have a small gallery that features traveling exhibits throughout the year. So we rotate 3 to 4 times a year with a new theme in our traveling exhibits gallery. We also have a theater. And our theater loops Holocaust survivor testimony all day long from 9 to 5 when the museum is open. And people have recorded their testimony, their experiences.
These are local people.
Local people, yes.
People from Dallas. Who've lived in Dallas for years and years. And a few of them, they'll be on the screen, and then they'll also be in the museum.
That's right. We do have about 8 Holocaust survivors living in the area that still speak publicly. All of them are over the age of about 75, so 75 on up. And they tell their stories to the 30,000 school children who visit the museum each year.
How long has the museum been there?
We've been in the West End since 2005. The museum was established as a memorial center for remembrance of the Holocaust by Holocaust survivors who settled in Dallas. And so originally it was a small exhibit in the lower level of the JCC over on North Haven, and they moved to the current location in 2005.
I say that because I'm not a big museum person, but I think it's kind of one of Dallas's best-kept secrets. And I don't know, maybe sometimes the sixth floor museum overshadows it, because that's the only way I even found out that the Holocaust Museum was there.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We do not want to be anyone's best kept secret, and we're working on our awareness. And one of the reasons we love being on David's program is because we get to talk about what we do and where we're located and why you should come.
And you can get there by DART rail.
Yes, we're right on the DART rail line. You get off at the West End station.
Absolutely, and it's actually very interesting to be by the DART rail, because you get that extra added experience when you're going through the museum. You get to hear those trains going by, and it just adds that extra element.
One place in the museum, there's an old boxcar that was brought in from Belgium that actually was an actual boxcar used to transport prisoners. And as you're standing there at the boxcar, you hear DART going by, and it is just eerie. It is,
I bet,
chilling. Yeah. From, you know, to be hearing that at the same time.
Yeah, it's ironic that we're on the right on the rail line. Transport of prisoners, most of them to death camps, was really the rail line is what made the Holocaust possible.
Yeah. The other part of it that is so interesting about this museum that I don't know that other Holocaust museums around the country have done is that all the artifacts come from local survivors, other than this boxcar, although it was local survivors who helped bring this boxcar in, and there is a link to one of our survivors with the boxcar, isn't there?
Yeah, Mike Jacobs, who helped to found the Dallas Holocaust Museum back in 1984, he went to Belgium and coordinated the shipment of a boxcar to the United States. And he did that very well. I mean, he was able to have that brought into Dallas at no cost. And it's been a big part of the museum's exhibit and reputation for the past 30 years. We're coming up on a 30th anniversary as well in 2014.
I think it's so interesting that, you know, I'm a native Texan, mm-hmm. and I was born down on the coast. And I think a lot of Texans don't understand just how a rich history the Jewish community has in Texas. I mean, in Waco, I went to school at Baylor, and in Waco is a huge population of Jewish citizens there in Dallas. And I don't think, you know, like, rural Texas really gets that. You know, they don't to grasp that. Is that something that you have in common across, like, with the Houston Museum? Do you give it a Texas spin at all?
We do have the kind of the experience in Dallas during the war is part of our exhibit. So there's a section that speaks to the headlines in the newspapers going on in 1943. And it's really, you really wish I had a visual, but we're on radio. The headlines speak to things that are, you know, beauty queens and lots of other stuff are on the front page. And then, you know, you'll go to page 6 or page 8 I think it was the Fort Worth
Star Telegram
that has, you know, this little story about, and it says, nearly a Jew to survive the war in Europe. And there's this small story that talks about how all the Jews are going to be exterminated, buried inside the newspaper, and yet a lot of Americans claim, you know, still in 1943, well, we didn't know. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what was happening to the Jews. And it just, it doesn't ring true. Maybe they weren't reading page 8 of the newspaper. But we do have a section dedicated to those headlines and to also talk about the injustices to people that were going on, that were happening in the United States during the time of the war, like civil rights violations and segregation. So there's a comparison there of, you know, how Americans were treating Americans to what was going on in Nazi Germany.
And we actually, you know, the internment camps for Japanese Americans.
Yes.
All of that was happening at the same time, too.
Right.
The artifacts that you have at the museum, are they traveling artifacts or are they there to stay?
They're all traveling. Nothing is really permanent. We expect in the next couple of years to move to a new home. And so we'll take our artifacts with us. And we do intend in the next year to have an artifact drive where we will be doing a call out to everyone in the area to send us their artifacts so that we can make more artifacts and archival material available to in our museum that are about the Holocaust survivors and their families that live in Dallas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But a lot of the artifacts, when you say, are they traveling artifacts, are things like eyeglasses and, you know, just real, real personal stuff. So, were some of the mics not on?
No, hers was down.
Oh, it was just down. Okay. We do this during the show. It's good professional radio here. Just in the middle, we just adjust our mics and... But a number of the things are just photographs. They're photographs that you're looking at these photographs, and there's one that just always haunts me when I see it. you see this kid in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto, because one this day is part of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, and he lives here in Dallas now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you talking about Max?
About Max.
Max Lobin. Yeah, he's a local celebrity. He speaks, across the country, really.
He does.
And Pam is really the person who helps to coordinate survivor speakers outside of the museum.
Right. Max has actually been doing a lot of traveling throughout Texas. I mean, we've even scheduled him going as far south as McAllen, down at the very tip in the border. So he really works hard to make sure that people know about the museum and people really think about the Holocaust. A big part of our mission is making sure that we reach young school children as much as possible. And I grew up in Dallas, and 20 years ago, I went to the museum when it was still at the Jewish Community Center, and I remember being able to walk through the boxcar. Mm-hmm. And this whole trip is an incredible vivid memory for me, and that's kind of what we're trying to make sure that we continue on with the museum, is just make sure that we can have these really important experiences for the kids that come through. Yeah. And Max makes that possible in a lot of ways, along with our other speakers.
You know, there's an effort in Dallas in the LGBT community to document our history, long decades and decades, the Dallas Way, and David's very involved in that. And so we could probably learn some things from you about how to preserve and capture and all of that. So we should go have a conversation. Oral histories and all of that.
That would be a great project for us to do together. The museum is really dedicated to being open and welcoming to every type of community and culture that is within our city and in the surrounding area. So any projects that we could do that would be unique, gathering information and learning how to really, build an archive and document a history in a proper way where it becomes useful to the next generation, would be a project that we could work on together.
Cool.
Yeah. Cool. Let's just change gears a little bit. You are doing a play for the first time at the museum.
That's right.
Now, you've hosted or co-produced or worked with Dallas Theater Center and Water Tower Theater in the past.
We've dabbled in some theater. I've worked with the museum for the past 3 years. And during that time, we have done some minor work ourselves, and then we also partnered with the Dallas Theater Center in 2011 as their community partner. And that was when they were doing production of Cabaret, which was widely successful, really well received in Dallas. And during that production, we were invited to just about every night after performance to do a talk back. And a talk back is when you're, someone from the museum and the cast and crew are up there really answering questions from the audience and trying to explain, the history behind Cabaret, which there's a long history of discrimination and propaganda that led up to the Holocaust, and Cabaret was one part of that. We did the same thing with the Water Tower Theater in 2012 for their production of Anne Frank. We did talkbacks, not after every performance, but after most performances. And The Timekeepers is our first ever production within the Dallas Holocaust Museum physical space. So this is a new venture for us, and one that is extremely exciting because we have a very unique environment to host a theater production, which it won't be quite the Wiley, but it will be interesting. I can promise you that.
I think it's going to be a wonderful, just a wonderful, almost off-Broadway-ish type play because it's it's in a industrial setting, and it's for kind of an industrial play, so it's going to be perfect.
That's a really good perspective, David. Because it is a small theater. The show itself, the way that we're configuring the room, will only have about 70, 75 seats in it for each performance. But it does have an industrial feel. The building that we're in is a historic building, and it was built in, I think, in the early 1900s. So it gives you the sense of, the architecture and the environment is, conducive to understanding the context of the play.
Now, anybody who'd like to go, we're going to give this information several times. It opens this Wednesday.
Pay What You Can. Preview night is June 12th, which is Wednesday.
Okay.
And opening night is June 13th.
Tickets are $20.
All tickets are $20 except for Pay What You Can Day.
And it's going to run
It'll run through June 22nd. We have six performances, the 12th through the 15th, and then the 21st and 22nd.
And when it's wildly successful, because you were just on our show, it can be extended.
Oh, possibly.
We've even considered that.
Let's announce that on the air before we talk about it. Yes.
Yes.
I'm sure your actors will be thrilled. They don't have any other projects.
They're smiling.
Lined up. So if you have some other gigs lined up, cancel them.
Make the time. I'm expecting it's going to be that successful.
I am too. Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
Well, your theater must be so excited. It's like, wow, I'm active during the day, and now I'm going to have some evening.
Yeah, we'll never be turning off the lights.
We're going to come back. Joe, who is the director, Joe Watts is the director. He's here with us, and we have two of the actors. There are three actors in this play. Carl Lewis and Jeremy Smith are here with us. They're going to be talking. Why don't we take our break? You ready to take a break? Okay. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more Pam Barnes, Maria McMullen from the Dallas Holocaust Museum. You guys stick around, but I'm going to bring them in. We have a limited number of mics, so we can only have a certain number of people on mic at the same time, but plenty of room in the studio, so you stay. You guys come in. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
In Dallas, local partners and national nonprofit Connect to Compete have made available for residents digital skills training classes. Classes include basic internet searching, internet basics, computer basics, and more. Local residents are also eligible for programs that provide assistance for internet service and computers. For more information on internet classes at local libraries, their phone number is 1-855-387-9166 or on the web at everyoneon.org. This program is in partnership with Dallas Area Libraries, Connect to Compete, and the Ad Council.
When they're gone for good. This is Scott from KNON's Texas Blues Radio telling you don't miss out on some great blues. KNON's Texas Blues Radio Volume 5 Blues CD. It's a CD put together by real blues fans for real blues fans like you. Texas Blues Radio Volume 5 features great local blues from Michael J. and the Paul Bird Band, J.J. and the Detonators, the Chris Watson Band, the Two Tones, Rough Cut Blues Band, Jeff Stone with Charlie Love, Dave Millsap, Sirloin and the Ass-Kicking Machine, Tutu Jones, Blues Boy Bo, Buddy Whittington, Andrea Dawson, Kirkland James, Sonny Colley, and Johnny Red and the Roosters. Get a copy now at Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie, Record Town in Fort Worth, and in Dallas at Bill's Records. This is a Dallas Blues collector's item. A very limited amount of vinyl copies can be found at Forever Young Records, the sponsor of this great blues project. CD downloads are available at cdbaby.com. Whether you get it as a download, on vinyl, or on CD, all the proceeds will benefit KNON. For more info on Texas Blues Radio Volume 5, visit KNON.org.
This is Lewis from UT Arlington, and I listen to Lambda Weekly podcasts at lambdaweekly.com.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laron Landis and the late Patty Fink. And our guests are from the Holocaust Museum, from a production of The Timekeepers. Two of the actors are here and the director. We have with us right now Joe Watts. He is the director. Welcome, Joe.
Well, I'm happy to be here, David. Thanks.
Tell us, how did you decide to do this show? First, what is the show about a little bit?
For me, I think the play is about the human spirit. It does obviously have some very serious moments to it, but I read about the play 5 or 6 years ago. It was off Broadway and got a really beautiful review. Mm-hmm. But my background in terms of how I came to bring the play to the Holocaust Museum is I started the first theater in Houston that did mostly all gay theme productions in 1983. So I've directed over 60 productions since then. And in 2004, I read that the Holocaust Museum in Houston was doing an exhibit called The Persecution and Assassination of Homosexuals in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And my mind lit up, and I thought about doing Bent there, and I contacted the museum. And event was done there, and the first year it sold out, and then we brought it back a second year and it sold out. And then I had the opportunity to do the Timekeepers at the Holocaust in Houston. But also I did the Laramie Project at the Holocaust Museum in 2011. And Matthew Shepard's mother came from Laramie to see my production, which was pretty overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part as far as the GLBT aspect is that Anise Parker, who's currently the lesbian mayor of Houston, she introduced Judy Shepard from the stage, and Judy gave a short speech before the production, and Judy received 3 standing ovations during her speech. I may get a little sentimental about that, but it was just so powerful. The mayor being there and Judy Shepard being there and the play itself, it was just one of the most wonderful evenings in theater that most people that were there, and it was sold out especially because Judy was coming. So I moved to...
Go, keep talking.
Okay. I moved to Dallas a year ago, February, for family reasons, and I was aware that there was a Holocaust Museum here as well, and so I approached Maria. We had a meeting about it. She was very in favor, very enthusiastic, and so here we are.
Now, if you want tickets, you can get tickets online at thetimekeepers.eventbrite.com. If you don't have that, you can always call the museum and get information. And the number at the museum is, Maria, just run over to the...
214-741-7500.
Okay. That's 214-741-7500. You can look it up online, DallasHolocaustMuseum.org. It opens on Wednesday, pay what you can, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Right.
The following week, Friday and Saturday.
Right.
Okay. With extra performances once we sell it out.
That'd be wonderful.
The people from the Holocaust Museum, for anybody who's not watching it, they're just going, oh. What kind of trouble are you getting us into? But they're used to me.
David's a troublemaker, you know?
Tell us a little bit about this show itself. It takes place during the Holocaust.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It's called The Timekeepers because there's a horologist, almost an amusing term, but it means someone that works on clocks and watches. And the particular Jewish man that does this in the camp is overloaded with work, obviously because they took the jewelry and the watches off of the prisoners. And so the camp decides that he has so much work that they need to bring in an assistant for him who turns out to be gay. So at first the Jewish man is not having any of it, but then they realize that they're going to be together 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so maybe they should start getting along. But the beautiful part that the playwright wrote in is that they both have a love for opera. And so they bicker and bitch.
Yeah, you
I don't know if that was a safe word or
we
not.
We call around that all the time.
All the time.
And that brings an awful lot of humor to what is somewhat a very serious subject. But just the fact that I'm sure that most of the prisoners didn't have the experience or the opportunity to share something like this together in camp. But, you know, it's about two people that are completely opposite, and they learn to get along, enjoy each other, laugh, and even go to loving each other. Not in a sexual tone at all, just as friends.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our two actors who are here are Carl Lewis and Jeremy Smith. You have a scene prepared from the play.
That's right.
Okay. Doc, did you want to move the camera?
that's
one of those things you don't normally say on radio. But You're going to use those two mics over there? We're just using this whole studio. We haven't been this creative in a long time. Why don't we do the scene, and then we'll talk to the actors. We'll get to know them a little bit better. But this is a scene from The Timekeepers.
It's a setup, if I will. Yeah. I picked this scene particularly because it's humorous and full of life. And it's a scene about when they first discover each other's love for opera.
Okay, now, do you need them facing the mics, or... Okay, why don't you turn your backs to us, face the mics, and and you'll be great. Good. This is from The Timekeepers.
Now what's wrong, little bird? La ridonnellestasie regante di palore e chi sono d'amore la suara ro o la dra
sono d'amore. You don't know the rest?
Of course I know the rest.
So, the horologist knows opera?
I love opera.
Are you sure you're not a homosexual?
What?
Just joking. I guess I'm some sort of humorologist. When did you start listening to opera?
It was always played in my home.
Oh, we had 3 seconds opera at home.
3 seconds?
Literally 3 seconds. When my father would be changing the stations on the radio, he'd mistakenly stop on a classical one and say, "Sounds like two cats screwing in the barn." He had such a turn with words. At his funeral, I selected 2 lovely cat screwing arias. It was the highlight of our relationship.
Oh.
That's definitely an O.
So how did you find opera?
Bless dear Heinrich. Soon after coming to Berlin, I met him, and he took me to my first opera, Puccini's La Boheme. And as soon as I heard Che Gelida Monina, I was in heaven. It's true. That's what heaven is. St. Peter will be standing in front of the Scala, and he'll say, "Hurry up! Hurry up, Hans! The curtain's going up!" and hand me a 10th row center seat for Puccini's Tosca.
All this from La Boheme? I could just imagine if you heard Verdi.
I probably would have fallen asleep.
Oh, you have 2 left ears.
You cannot possibly even think of comparing Verdi with Puccini.
No comparison possible. Verdi is cream, Puccini is mud.
Mud? I wouldn't even put Verdi in the same class as Giordano, or Pocacelli, or Chilea.
You just haven't experienced opera. Haven't Verdi's choruses made your soul laugh?
Not music.
Not music, his orchestration.
Technical. He has no sense of poetry.
Oh, you are deaf.
Puccini's romance, passion.
What do you know of these things?
What do you know of these things?
Enough. We speak different languages. That's it.
That's it?
That's it. Over.
It's over because you decided?
Enough.
Some father you must have been.
I was a good father. I was.
I could just imagine what you think of UC Borling.
Oh, that's a tenor.
Pure unadorned singing.
Shading, such a sensitive
yes,
shading of colors.
That tone.
Inner feelings.
As if Puccini was writing for him.
No, he was Verdi's instrument.
Histrionics. Verdi leads his singers to histrionics.
Enough.
No, not enough. What about Kirsten Flagstan?
A diva. Notes that angels couldn't reach.
She ate her notes. And if she had a knife and fork in her hand, she'd turn around and eat the scenery.
Blasphemy!
You're right. I was just enoughing you.
Oh, her
Kirsten
Aida.
Is the diva. Her Tosca. You do laugh.
Only on July 17th.
Is that today's date?
Mm-hmm. You'll never be a horologist.
Do you think so?
What does it matter what I think?
Oh, you're getting serious again. I thought on July 17th you'd smile.
Only once.
Well, at least I was here for it.
Then it counts.
Do you want to comment on the scene a little bit?
It comes fairly early
mm-hmm.
in the play. And it's just, it's so much fun in terms of how passionate they are in with different composers and so forth. And I think that's the turning point when they start bonding because of that. It gets more serious and it changes back to a little more light. It's not a depressing production in the least. It is about the human spirit. So I want people to come and enjoy that part of it and you know, it takes place at a concentration camp, but, you know, something beautiful did happen there.
Right.
You guys are really wonderful.
Yeah, pretty good.
That was awesome scene.
Why don't you two guys come on in here so that we're not talking to each other's backs? You can share that microphone right there. And Carl, let me just ask you first, how is it to play a straight guy?
Well, very interesting. Here we have it where the straight actor is playing gay and the gay actor is playing straight. Mm-hmm. I have done other roles in the past where, well, I played different characters and I had co-actors say, well, you know, you play them better than you ever do a straight guy.
Okay, and so Jeremy, anything about playing gay?
Not in the slightest. You know, as an actor, you're never allowed to pass judgment on somebody that you want to play. So that, you know, and plus I have history. You know, it's 2013, and I'm fairly young, so the world is pretty open-minded these days as far as me growing up. So maybe a little bit different than maybe an older generation.
Joe, was that intentional?
No.
It just happened to work out that way.
Well, yeah. What I think was so unique, in as much as the play is about their love for opera, Jeremy's brother actually teaches opera singers
at SMU.
Yep.
Wow.
And Carl's partner is always sings in the chorus of Dallas Grand Opera. So the chance of that happening are what? I don't know. 1 in 10,000, 1 in 1,000,000. So, I mean, that was just kind of freaky and cool. And when I learned that, it was like, oh, wow.
Did the two of you get some coaching from?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Neither of us are the singers in our households.
Yes, definitely.
So, criticism and. What's it been like living with them?
Well, learning the proper pronunciation, the proper phrasing. And, yeah, they want us to sound good, but, hey, some of this, we're just singing to ourselves while we work. So,
there were many times in the rehearsal process I would say, is that really how it's pronounced?
Yes, they did work on us with all our words, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Do your relatives that are in opera, do they have opinions about what you're saying about these composers and
musicians? That's a really great question.
Well, my partner doesn't really care for comic opera. He loves Verdi. He loves, the German composers. So.
Yeah, my brother is the same. He likes Puccini and he likes some things, but it's very particular. The people we mentioned a minute ago, he was just kind of roundabout about it. Just kind of enjoys all of it, I guess.
I thought maybe they'd have some, like, you know, cranky thing. Yes, that's exactly how I feel.
My brother doesn't like Don Carlo, the opera, which we sing a lot throughout the play. So.
Oh, well.
Is there a reason for the particular operas that are chosen in this?
Well, actually, yes. Playwright picked these particular opera segments for what we're singing about. Yes, we're singing in Italian, but the words are very meaningful. What we just sang about, it was, as I started, I'm talking to a watch and I say, what's wrong, little bird? And the words translate as, what a joy to see again the one that I cherish, to hear a word of love again come from her heavenly lips and then to perish. And so it really has a resonance for those that understand the context of what we're doing in the opera.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You both have somewhat of an acting background.
Yes.
Jeremy, you just got back from California. You spent several years out there.
Yeah, go back and forth between Los Angeles. I started acting in about 97. 2001, I became a member of SAG. Acted in a Tarzan series back on Fox years ago. Toured the East Coast with the Von Ryan Players doing Othello. And, you know, some guest spots, some commercials here and there as it comes and goes.
Mm-hmm. And?
Well, my first gig was back in 1970, we won't say when.
Mentioning that, I just ran across an article where it said, it was mentioning me, and it's a David Taffet, 39, and I said, isn't that funny? I'm 39 this year, too. So, you know, sometimes things change, sometimes they don't. So,
but no, I started as a puppeteer at Six Flags. And, yeah, I did, you know, volunteer community theater off and on. But I've not acted for over a decade. I was focusing more on music. I play in orchestras and in bands. And then had an opportunity to come to an actor's workshop that Joe was running at Cathedral of Hope. And he saw and was interested in what I was able to offer and asked me to come audition.
Do you use, and I'm always interested in this, do you use a particular method of acting? And here's the background of that question. A lot of people who've listened know that I've done, like, Friday Night Lights, have a part that's, like, one line long, if that, in all of these different episodes that I was in, but had lots of fun doing it. And in talking to other actors who came from much further than just Dallas down to Austin to film these, we're sitting talking about, oh, what method do you use? And, my method is, if the director tells me to do something, I do it because I don't care what... That's my method.
I think yours is the blurt method.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I was educated, I guess, under T.A. Taylor at Katie's Studio, my first teacher. And then after that, I went to the Beverly Hills Playhouse. And so I've studied different types of methods under Stan Sklosky and all as that comes about. I feel like at the Playhouse, it was broken down for me. It's kind of mix them together. Sometimes I will be a method actor. Sometimes I will be more technical as far as how I approach a role. I think it all depends on the role and where you need to go with the character.
For me, it's when I'm working with a puppet, it's what's going to get that emotion through this chunk of felt and styrofoam. I also tap into my own experiences to find the depth of emotion required. Honestly, this role is larger and more demanding than any that I've taken on.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
I think what was interesting about going back to what the lyrics mean that apply to situations in this play is that a lot of it is because Benjamin was separated from his wife and his two children, and Hans is able to get information about his family through sexual favors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's kind of a powerful little subplot. Wow.
We're going to take a break with that. You can get tickets to Timekeepers by going to the Timekeepers event, thetimekeepers.eventbrite.com. You can get tickets or get information on how to get tickets by calling the museum where the play is going to be staged. The Holocaust Museum is on Record Street right at the railroad tracks, the DART tracks, one block from West End Station. The number, if you want to call the Holocaust Museum, is 214-741-7500. You can go online to DallasHolocaustMuseum.org. All the information will be there. If you still can't get any information, just Google Maria McMullen and call her at home. No, Maria said...
But I'm never home.
Oh, okay. She's always at the museum, so just call the museum. Ask for Maria. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON-FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink and Ron Landis, who is dying. And we will be back with more right after this.
GoodSearch.com provides a way for you to support nonprofits like KNON with your online shopping and dining. GoodSearch.com offers a downloadable toolbar for searching from your computer called Good App, so your purchases can go to support KNON. With Good Dining, every time you go out to eat at participating restaurants, then a portion of what you spend gets donated to KNON. Registering is easy at GoodSearch.com, and KNON 89.3 is the name to enter in your account settings for charity selection. Support KNON with your online shopping and dining at GoodSearch.com.
Hi there, this is Shawnee inviting you to my R&B guitar party on Father's Day, Sunday, June the 16th at Port Davis Pub, starring George Stansdale, Cookie McGee, Jimmy Preacher Ellis, Sam Whitaker, and Chester Burns, featuring Jewel, for a Sunday evening of fine rhythm and blues guitar.
Included is a free chicken dinner courtesy of Henderson Chicken while it lasts, so get there early to eat. Doors open at 4 p.m. Tickets are available now at knon.org. Bill's Records and Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie. Poor David's Pub is located at 1313 South Lamar in Dallas on the south side.
Make this a Father's Day to remember with George Stansdale, Cookie McGee, Jimmy Preacher Ellis, Sam Whitaker and Chester Burns featuring Jewel and me, Short Stay, at my R&B guitar party on Sunday, June the 16th at Port Davis Pub. This is a KNON benefit event.
Tickets are also available at the new location of Henderson Chicken at Walnut Hill Lane and 35 and at the Henderson Chicken on Grand Avenue.
This is Raphael McDonald from Resource Center Dallas. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
We love this. Anyway, we're on the air. Where are we?
We're back.
Where are we? We're in the station, in the studio.
Listening to Lambda Weekly.
Thank you. And you are?
Laurent Landis.
With the late Patty Fink, and I'm David Taffet, and we have lots of guests here in the studio. I like this controlled chaos that we're doing today. Maria, I think your kids disappeared.
Did I bring my kids?
Yeah, you brought your kids.
All right.
They're gone. Phineas and
Auden.
And Auden, they're
missing
in action. Sorry. But the show must go on.
There'll be a pledge premium the next pledge drive.
That's a good idea. We've never given away kids as a pledge premium.
Oh, Lord.
We have on mic with us right now... the director and two stars of the play The Timekeepers. It's going to be staged at the Holocaust Museum. If you'd like to get tickets for it, go to thetimekeepers.eventbrite.com. For the second week, it's thetimekeepers2.eventbrite.com. Or go to dallasholocaustmuseum.org or call the museum at 214-741-7500. And if none of that works... just call Pam or Maria. They would be delighted to talk to you.
Tickets at Will Call, too.
Oh, and you can just get tickets at Will Call.
The box office will be open 1 hour before the show.
Right. Joe, you were just telling us a line that you just really love from this play.
When the Jewish horologist decides to help Hans in learning how to repair watches, they come to a part, and he's a little rough with a particular watch, and he says...
No, slower, much slower. She must be handled gently.
How do you know this is a she watch?
All watches are women. Clocks are men.
Maybe I do better with clocks.
I love that.
That's a good line. That's a great line.
And the closing of this particular scene goes like...
Are you paying close attention?
Memory. No notes.
Good.
Now, am I a horologist?
About one-fourth of one.
Thanks. That makes me a whore.
So it's a very clever play, even though it takes place in a concentration camp during the Holocaust. I'm looking forward to seeing it. And we're trying to sell this out. Not that it benefits us. It benefits the Holocaust Museum.
Absolutely.
But we're trying to sell it out to extend the run so that these two actors will not be starving and out on the street. I've worked with actors before. I know how it is. I don't want you on the street starving.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. We do our best.
Yes,
you said that this is your, Carl, that it's your biggest role that you've done. How have you prepared to do that? Like, put your whole life aside?
We have been rehearsing almost nonstop ever since Memorial Day. We rehearsed before that. A lot of study, a lot of memorization, and all different types of mnemonic tricks to try to recall what we're saying. It really took us a while to get the script down because the two of us are on the stage almost the entire 90 minutes of the play. But once we got the lines, we started to be able to tap into the truth of what we're saying. Now, you know, being a puppeteer, I tend to go a little bit too broad at times from that. But Joe has helped me to pull back and define... the quiet moments, the moments that are more reflective in my character.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also that after the memorization, and just like Hans and Benjamin, me and Carl have spent a lot of time together, and so our relationship, I think, is our chemistry has definitely grown, and we've definitely bonded just as friends, mm-hmm. as we do spend a lot of time together.
Mm-hmm. I used to be a theater major myself and in college, and one of the most challenging things is when we did one-act plays, and we didn't do anything, the plays with no props. and little to no scenery. And that was a big challenge because you don't realize it, but when you have a lot of props, that can take up time, just walking around, picking up things, whatever. It kills time. But I don't know, do you have a lot of props or scenery in this play?
No, it's just us and the desk and a couple watches. And that's about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think so. So
we're there on stage the whole time.
So it is. I assume that's a challenge.
It very much so, to stay in character and for the full 90 minutes, and to make sure that to transition into deeper scenes and come out of deep scenes into light scenes within maybe a 5 to 10 second fade out is very, very difficult.
Actually, we do have a lot of props because almost all of our props are watches.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I'm not actually a horologist. I only play one on stage. So, yeah, I'm not taking the watches apart. They are falling apart, but I don't actually mean to. So,
gotcha. Now, one thing that's interesting about the way you describe that, it's from my real limited acting, it's exactly the opposite of what I've ever done. Learning the lines are always the last thing that you do when you're doing TV or film, but you get into the character first. So first I had to imagine that I was a reporter. Not very difficult for me. But you know what? A whole bunch of other people that were on the show would look at me if it was just happened to be a day where we weren't really doing anything real serious. I remember one episode, several of them looked at me. They said, "What's wrong with you today?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, you're just not into it." And I said, "Well, we're not doing anything. I mean, we were sitting up in the stands, not really just watching the football game." They said, "But you're the one who always gets us into it because you're so into being who you are." And I do. And then it's at the last minute that they'll throw in a line and they'll say, "Okay, go up to the coach and ask him this," or go over, you know. So it's exactly the opposite. And I am so much not a stage actor. I mean, I'm in awe of actors who can act on the stage because I can't memorize a script. I can remember one line and still screw it up the first time. And then as soon as it's done, I've forgotten it. So you're doing the opposite.
I think we kind of had to, through the script being so... Mm-hmm. The way it's set up. Mm-hmm. And the memorization definitely had to come mm-hmm. right away so we could kind of start exploring other directions of our characters, at least for me. I think, you know, once we got that down, because it was a huge chunk to get out the way.
Mm-hmm. No, I'll defer to Jeremy on this because he has, you know, exposure to both sides of that.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, I feel like film is... I try to do theater at least once a year to stay sharp because mm-hmm. it's work. Film, to me, is much easier... Mm-hmm. You know, as far as like you said, to get in character, to do it over and over and then get out, this is something you have to study for, you know, a month and make sure you have it down mm-hmm. and then perform it. So two very different sides.
Right. You know, what's interesting from a GLBT standpoint is over the years, 30 years that I directed 60 productions in Houston, a lot of theater people would ask me, "Joe, why do you direct only gay-themed productions?" And my simple answer is because I want to. And I don't direct anything that I don't have a passion for. Mm-hmm. And believe me, my passion for this play is huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
It sounds like a wonderful story. Do we know about the playwright? Is the playwright LGBT?
Yes. Yes.
Hmm. It sounds like it has a powerful medium to explore lots of different things about the LGBT community and thoughts in a very specific time.
The play is almost hidden in some respects. It's been done around the world. It's been done in Germany and Israel and all of that, but it's not a play that's recognized a lot. It's not necessarily done a lot, sadly, to my estimation. But, you know, thankfully it was done off-Broadway, and that's when I read about it and was able to get the script, and then the rest is history, or herstory.
Horstory.
I want to bring in the, at least one of the Holocaust Museum people, again, Pam or Maria. You wanted to talk a little bit about volunteering at the Holocaust Museum.
Yeah, the museum has a really robust
volunteer program. It's grown with Pam's leadership, really. Pam is the volunteer coordinator. With her leadership, we've grown from a handful of volunteers all the way to 150.
Closer to 200 now, actually.
Over 200, nearly 200 volunteers at the museum. And there are so many opportunities to get involved. You know, it's hard to imagine what it takes to run a small museum. Day-to-day operations take up a lot of staff time. We only have 11 staff people at the museum, and yet we see on the average of, 5,000-6,000 people a week.
Wow.
So it is, you know, a tremendous undertaking to run a museum that has visitors all day long. There's opportunities to docent, which is more than a tour guide. It's really going through an in-depth training program to learn the material, learn the exhibits, really learn the history. So you're more than just a tour guide. You're becoming an educator for students and other visitors who come to the museum. We are opening up new opportunities to volunteer in our library, help us categorize and catalog our archives, and administrative projects. So we have something for everyone at the museum.
And this is one thing. Most people assume that everybody who works at the museum is Jewish and that everybody who volunteers at the museum is Jewish, and actually nobody who works at the museum is Jewish.
This is my favorite question. Yeah. I get this all the time. The first thing, you know, I don't consider myself very interesting, but the first thing people want to ask me when I say I work at the Dallas Holocaust Museum, they say, wow, it's amazing, but are you Jewish? Mm-hmm. And I said, no. And they're like, well, okay, well, the Holocaust isn't just about the Jewish people. It's not just for the Jewish people. It's a much larger subject. And so there are two employees out of 11 working at the museum right now who are Jewish. And the rest of us are, you know, finding ourselves or not really having a religion of sorts. But the subject matter is wider and broader than the Jewish community. And one of the reasons that we exist, and it's so important that we give this gift to the city of Dallas, this Holocaust Museum and Education Center, is because the education about Holocaust, about tolerance, about acceptance needs to be given to everyone, needs to be available to everyone.
Right. Right, and that's really the theme of the museum. It's about tolerance. It's, I mean, educating about the mm-hmm. Holocaust, but the theme is about tolerance.
It is about tolerance.
And there's no other museum in the city that does that.
There's no other organization in the region that is dedicated to teaching tolerance and moving people forward to acceptance, so that we become a city, a community, a country of people who accept one another, who don't see differences. They just see one human race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're all upstanders here at the show.
So yes, you
Dallas,
are.
We've had the Dallas Holocaust Museum on several times.
Yeah. You are ultimate upstanders, and I'm so happy that you allowed us to come. We're very honored to be part of this.
I thought you were going to mention that they are the only museum that preaches tolerance, because museums like the Dallas Museum of Art just preach hate. No.
Didn't say that. David said that.
David says things like that.
Well, you know, we're not going to have them on anyway, so we don't care what we say about them.
Well, real quick, I know that,
my co-hosts are looking at me like, okay, this time he's just gone.
Yeah, he lost
doing
it.
Doing his best to get the only person from the staff in trouble today.
Yes, I am.
I know, like, it's a big educational opportunity for people to come to the museum. Do you all ever go out and go to schools or anything?
We absolutely do. We do have traveling programs. Holocaust survivors go out and speak to schools directly. We go out and speak to schools directly. We work with different theaters and partner with other organizations in the city and around the area to talk to all different types of groups. We have a lot of opportunities to work with corporations and organizations where we can give a free talk or brown bag lunch to employees about tolerance, about the Holocaust, about, you know, different related subjects.
Is the exhibit also over at Old Red still?
We do have a small exhibit at Old Red through July, I think.
Is it through July? Okay. And tell us what that is.
Boy, I wish I could. I didn't set up that exhibit.
Oh, okay.
It's about Richard Kramer, isn't
it? It's about the Holocaust as it relates to Dallas. So that's why we're in the Old Red. It really is about how the Holocaust relates to Dallas. So it features one example is Clarice Tinsley's report on bringing in the boxcar when it was first brought in. So it's really kind of the evolution of the Holocaust Museum in Dallas and about the survivors itself.
Okay.
A couple of different elements. We have an exhibit on Rudy Baum, who was a liberator. Mm-hmm. He was actually a Jewish immigrant into the States, and then he joined the Army and went back to be a liberator. Huh. So very fascinating things over there.
And I just want to get in one last plug for the show. It's the Timekeepers. It's going to be at the Holocaust Museum. Opens this Wednesday, runs Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Then the following week on Friday and Saturday, you can call the museum to reserve tickets or go online to thetimekeepers.eventbrite.com. Joe, the director, just give us, for people who've just tuned in, just a little synopsis what the play is.
It's about the human spirit, and it takes place at a concentration camp with a Jewish man who is a horologist, someone that works on clocks and watches, and they bring in an assistant who happens to be a gay man, and it develops into a close bond and relationship with the two of them. It is about the human spirit, and it's not all serious. It has a lot of wonderful, warm, and funny moments to it.
And Carl?
Yeah, we develop a bromance.
And Friday nights is the talkback night.
The Friday night performances will be followed by a talkback, live talkback with the cast and with museum staff, which will give people an opportunity to learn more about the show and about the Holocaust.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you all. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, David.
And
thank
Joe
you, David.
And Carl
thank
and
you.
Jeremy. And we'll
Pam.
Be back. And Pam. And we'll be back with more Lambda Weekly next week.